Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. And thank you to Ron Trammell and the Cats Tribute Band for our intro music. Today is August 28th, 2020, a Friday morning here in Nashville. As I record this, the remnants of Hurricane Laura are moving into our area, and it should make for a very rainy weekend. As we get started, let me remind everyone to like our Facebook page and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. This is so that you don't miss any episodes. Tennessee and the Tennessee Valley are blessed with such an abundance of traditional music, handicrafts, food, occupations, and avocations, pastimes, and children's games. It is a folklore's paradise. Well, yesterday I had the pleasure of sitting down and talking with an actual folklorist. In fact, the state folklorist for Tennessee, Dr. Bradley Hansen. This was my first time to get acquainted with Dr. Hansen and to get an update on the activities of this important state office. Sounds to me like he has his hands full and great plans for the future of this important program. And so I hope you'll enjoy this interview with Dr. Bradley Hansen. Bradley Hansen, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Bradley, it's nice to finally get to meet you. I've been delinquent in not having called you up earlier, knowing that your predecessor in your job had left that position five or six years ago. Speaking of Dr. Roby Cogswell, a well-known folklorist, Tennessee Arts Commission historically. So welcome to Tennessee, belatedly.
Thank you. Yeah,
I want to hear about what you're doing in the at the Arts Commission and the Tennessee Folklife Project. But before we do that, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got here in Tennessee. What's your inspiration?
So I was born in Sioux City, Iowa, up there on the Iowa, South Dakota, Nebraska border, and graduated from high school there. Lived there my whole early life, and then went to the University of South Dakota for my bachelor's degree in music. I'd gotten interested in singing in high school, choral music, art song, recital type music. Didn't have a great big voice, so, you know, some opera, but mostly smaller kind of stage music. And pursued that and enjoyed that time and decided after I finished to go get a master's degree in voice at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, the conservatory there. That lasted about a year before I just knew this was not where I needed to be, or at least not where I was headed. I was not going to be a singer or a voice teacher, probably. But I'd gotten much more interested in the research side of music and music history, and was able to pivot there in the conservatory into the music history program, and did finish the voice master's, but also then did a music history master's degree. And at that same time, I guess my mid-20s, I was really getting interested in American vernacular music. There was a lot of it in the air at the time. The Oh Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack had turned a lot of young people on to that. All the cool recordings Johnny Cash was making at the end of his life were really sort of hip at the time. And I fell right into that. And I got interested in the Carter family and the Stanley Brothers, early bluegrass, early country, Jimmy Rogers. I listened to anything I could get at the library or anywhere else. And this was not totally unfamiliar to me. I had grown up in a household of country music and knew these folks as historical figures. But for some reason, the music and the people and the culture of it really resonated with me, even though I had not grown up in it or even really ever experienced it. But lo and behold, after I finished all that work in Kansas City, I didn't have a job. I didn't know what I was going to do next. For a variety of reasons, I ended up moving to Knoxville, Tennessee. Who could have known that this was one of the greatest music cities in the South, and a city that reveals itself to people, I think, better than Nashville, in my opinion. I moved there and just right away could find my way through the musical scene, through the local community radio station, WDVX, through concerts at the Laurel Theater, a wonderful historic nonprofit there that puts on traditional music concerts.
I can't tell you how many times I've been to the Laurel Theater. When I lived in Gatlinburg and Sevierville area, we would come down at night and check out what was going on, and never disappointed.
Oh no, it's a magical experience, really, anytime you go there. And I went to everything I could go to there, really. I don't know if I missed much those couple of years. Slowly but surely, I got to know some of the people involved, like Brent Cantrell, who's a wonderful folklorist who runs the Jubilee Community Arts, the Laurel Theater, and some of the folks at the radio station, and also met Bobby Fulcher towards the winter and early spring of 2007. I met Bobby, and after we had a conversation, he invited me to apply for a job as a summer seasonal on the Cumberland Trail, his state park that he's running, to do culture work, because he learned about my interest in music. But now, simultaneous to this, I had decided to go try to do a PhD in ethnomusicology, which is the study of people making music, the cultural study of music, the anthropological study of music, and had been admitted to Brown University. I knew I was going to Brown in August of 2007, but I started with Bobby in May of 2007. At Brown, I got to work with Jeff Todd Titan, who's a major ethnomusicologist, and here in Tennessee, I was getting to work with Bobby Fulcher, a major folklorist who would go on to get the National Heritage Fellowship.
Right.
So all of a sudden, I had these two incredible mentors over the next decade, really. They're still my mentors to this day, both of them. I was off and running. I did the PhD, I did the field work in Campbell County, which was an amazing experience. I was able to research a music community there for many, many years because of the opportunity Bobby gave me. Did the dissertation, moved back to Tennessee, again without a job. And then Roby Cogswell retired. I didn't think Roby was even old enough to retire. He's always looked the same, I think.
Exactly.
But he was a little bit of a shocker to see that he was retiring. He was such an institution. He had been there 30 years. And through the summer and fall, I applied for the job, did two interviews, ended up getting the job just days after I got married. And then in January of 2015, I loaded up my car from Clinton, 3 hours away, whatever it is, and drove to Nashville really early in the morning to start my job as the director of folk life for the whole state. And slowly but surely have found my way and now do live in Nashville, I'm happy to say.
Well, you mentioned Bobby Fulcher, and I should say for the benefit of our listeners that Bob started the Tennessee State Parks Folk Life Project back in 79 and is a friend of this program, as a guest on this program a couple of years ago. He's a dear friend and just a character.
Yeah, one of the most persuasive people I've ever known to really bring you into a project and make you feel like it's your mission in life. Within minutes or maybe an hour, he can get you going and make you feel as excited about something as he does. It's a wonderful gift, and make you feel as almost as informed about it because of his ability to deliver large amounts of information in a compelling way quickly. It's amazing.
Well, I have had the rare opportunity to actually be his boss at one time or another, and that certainly is a challenge. But
yeah, I'm sure,
because we have and still do have a bunch of free spirits in the Tennessee State Park system, and there he is one of those, and but he's continued on. So tell us, what the Folk Life Program within the Arts Commission, what are its components? How is it set up?
So the Folk Life Program is just one program among many at the Tennessee Arts Commission.
Okay.
The Arts Commission is the government's arts council. We work for the state of Tennessee. And there are state folklorists in almost every state. They're not always in the state Arts Council. They could be in the Humanities Council or other places. And a lot of these jobs were set up by the National Endowment for the Arts in the early 1980s. And people like Roby Cogswell were sort of the first generation of people to hold these jobs, to fight for these positions, to to really define them, shape them. And a lot of those first generation of folks are retiring, and then people like me are coming into their jobs. It seemed like these jobs are sort of like Supreme Court justice positions. You know, people really hold them for a long time. They get them, they hold them, and then they turn over. And I don't know, maybe I'll last that long. But the components, the Tennessee Arts Commission's biggest sort of agency-wide initiative is our many, many grants programs.
We provide
all sorts of grants, project grants, operating support grants, grants directly to artists, technical assistance grants. In Folklife, we work on about 50 grants. Most of those are project grants. Some are operating support grants. But we have about 50 or so grants across the state, rural and urban counties. These are festivals, concerts, craft fairs, powwows, festivals devoted to distinct ethnic groups across the state. And it's rich and rewarding. People often think, oh God, grants work. That sounds tedious. That sounds transactional. But it's really cool to connect people to resources and see them complete their projects and do it year after year.
So what are your priorities when you consider who might be a worthy candidate for a grant? You obviously must have some priorities.
There's a whole application process. So
People
have to make their case. And those grants go in front of a panel of citizen experts. We actually don't make any decisions about how grants are rated or ranked within a panel process. They are scored by panels that we assemble from experts across the state.
Okay.
We do our best to get everybody in the best shape they can be in terms of their application narrative and their budget. We try to get them all as good a shape as they can. And our agency is known for being high touch, they say. We will give you as much technical assistance as we can and as that you come and get from us. It's always disappointing, I guess you would say, when a group doesn't reach out to us and they simply submit an application, because we'll read it, we'll work on you with it. But in terms of our outreach, of course we're looking for underrepresented communities, rural communities, rural organizations, organizations of color, immigrant organizations, trying to make sure that they know we're here and that they can get plugged into this process too, and that our money goes all over the state. And we pride ourselves that we have money in all 95 counties every year. We look at it, we reach a certain point in time of the year. If we don't think we've got coverage everywhere, we go out and aggressively recruit and make sure that we can show that we're reaching the whole state. It's a hard thing to do from Nashville. We sometimes feel cut off, you know. But we're looking for, we have everything from highly professional organizations that have grant writers to entirely volunteer organizations, to organizations that don't have great English skills. So it runs the gamut of what we're working on.
So is the object to document the folklore type of activity, or is it to promote it, or both, or?
A little bit of both. To be honest, we don't have a lot of grants come in that are strictly about documenting.
Okay.
And part of that is because we're the Arts Commission. And so people tend to think that the projects that are well suited to us are our performances, are something that faces the audience in a kind of performance concert festival.
So to showcase the
showcase.
Yeah.
But now documentation is a part of our own strategic plan. We as folklorists on staff document, and we would love and do love when organizations come to us with projects that are about documenting. It's not the overwhelming majority, mm-hmm. and we should do a better job of recruiting those, to be honest with you, but we need to build that in. But we do a lot of documenting ourselves, and people do a lot of self-documenting now. It's really easy to self-document, but that's a whole other story. But yeah, I would say presenting, preserving through presenting, educating through presenting, they're all tied together.
You know, folklore is such a wide and all-encompassing sort of field, as you certainly know, but you know, it can be anything from food ways to the experiences of various forms of labor and craftsmanship, and of course music and dance. All these things can be part of folklore. You know, Tennessee is changing. We have new cultural components coming in. I was thinking of Hispanic heritage and Latino culture. My goodness, what a challenge.
Yeah. Well, it is a challenge. It's really exciting. And we've kind of addressed that through a couple different mechanisms. One, we've had way back into Roby's time, he worked with a woman named Dana Everts Bain, who became the Folklife Program Assistant, a full-time employee along with Roby. She was a Spanish speaker. Her research had been in Mexican culture. And so she was able to do a vast survey, ongoing survey, of venues, artists, organizations, and events related to Latino and immigrant culture in the state of Tennessee. She did that for years, and it's been picked up and carried on by now Evangela Mead, who works with me. So we have a formal, ongoing program to document and really survey, meaning just find out what's out there in terms of new immigrant and Latino artists and organizations. If they are at the stage where they're a nonprofit organization, we do everything we can to inform them about our grants program and get them plugged in there. If they're not at that stage, you know, we'll document them, we'll try to keep up with their events. And then through our apprenticeship program, which is where we fund master artists to pass on traditions to the next generation, typically, we try to have a very diverse slate every year. There hasn't been a year of that program where we haven't had a Latino or immigrant artist, at least one, represented. And that's cool because in a press release or in an exhibit, the oldest Tennessee traditions are listed alongside these traditions that are very new. And you get a colorful picture of contemporary Tennessee. And we never want people, I think maybe one of the biggest challenges in doing folklife work is that people think it's about history. I'm not a historian. I don't study history. Everything I'm looking at exists today. It might be very old. You know, the tradition of coopering, barrel making, bucket making, it's very old, but it exists now.
Right.
And so does Panamanian dressmaking. And so does Honduran wood carving. These things all exist in this state right now. They're not a part of history. They might have great time depth, but they're here now. And so we work with folk life. We work with living traditions. Sometimes they're down to one person.
Sure.
And we're trying to do our best to make sure there's at least one more doing it.
But, you know, in preparing for the interview today, I went on your website and there are several things for the listeners to tune into, but the one that caught my eye was the Newberry chair making operation, and it's a two-part video, you know, maybe 40 minutes in length, and guy goes through the entire process of making a chair, you know, from cutting down the tree and sawing the lumber, and it's just completely fascinating.
Yeah, and those things are out there, and the people that know they're out there love it, but they sometimes take it for granted, thinking it'll always be there, and then there are other people that don't know it's there at all.
Right.
And there's a small group of us that know it's there and love that it's there and want to make sure it continues to be there. So if you take Mark Newberry, he's sort of the generation. I don't know how old Mark is. He wouldn't want me to say, but you know, he's youngish. He's maybe 45, 50. He's the youngest generation doing this work. And he taught in our apprenticeship program, he taught his adult niece, the first time a female member of the family had been brought in, I think, had been brought in to the chair making. So, you know, the Newberrys have won the State Folklife Heritage Award.
Right.
They've documented in books and numerous documentaries. And that's warm and fuzzy when you log on to the internet and you see all that stuff. But in my job, you think, what happens after Mark? You know, I don't want it to be on my watch, if we know about these things, that the Newberry chair makers can't do this anymore. And it's tough. It's tough to be a chair maker. It's tough to be a full-time chair maker or a full-time anything of that sort, of a handicraft that takes
sure.
so much time and investment. And so we loved working with Mark, and he's a Tennessee treasure. His dad is still working with him every day, and They're incredible. They do incredible work.
So your background is music, and I know you're geeing and hawing with Bob Fulcher. So what's turning you on these days in Tennessee music?
Oh man, it's too much to sometimes even wrap my head around. I'll tell you, when I was in East Tennessee, I worked with a community of mostly bluegrass musicians. And older bluegrass musicians who had come up in the generation where they were born listening to the Grand Ole Opry. I thought of them as sort of the Grand Ole Opry generation. Every one of them had a story about listening to the Opry when they were a kid. So they were of that generation that was kind of the radio age.
On the radio, exactly.
On the radio. And what did they do when they became adults? They started their own radio shows. And I'm talking about the 50s and 60s.
Or radio stations, yeah.
Or radio stations, right. Yeah. Every little town, it seemed like, had a live Saturday night radio show that was a small town version of the Grand Ole Opry. Sometimes these shows lasted a year. Sometimes they lasted decades. And so I was really interested in those guys and gals because they were still around. The shows weren't really, but they were. So the bluegrass community in East Tennessee is rich. But then when I moved to Middle Tennessee, I started going to all these contests, and that's fiddle music typically and banjo music, an older type of music, old time music. Of course that exists in East Tennessee too, but the contest scene in Middle Tennessee seemed richer. And if you go to one of these contests, it's almost all young people. So the old-time music scene in Tennessee is great, the bluegrass scene. And in West Tennessee, African-American traditions persist. Blues and soul. We're starting to work. We work with Stax. You know, Stax has a nonprofit now, the great record label. We work with them, and we're getting to know the Memphis music scene. And I'm talking to some soul musicians about possibly doing some apprenticeships. We've worked with some an African-American blues musician named Dudley Harris, who was in rural West Tennessee. People don't often know that there's an incredibly rich rural African-American culture in Tennessee. It's not just in Memphis. It's through the West. So, you know, all these things are exciting to me. We worked on a fife and drum project. We've worked on ballad singing, which, you know, that was one of Bobby's big passions, was the ballad singing of the Cumberland Plateau.
Sure.
But there's still a family that does it. The Hicks family.
The Hicks family. Mm-hmm.
He's still working with them, and he wrote an incredible application for them, let me tell you, to be in the apprenticeship program.
Oh, is that right?
Not only an application, but a curriculum for them that was through the roof. But they did the project, and they had, I think, three elders served as masters, and then four or five of the next generation served as apprentices. And they did a series of concerts, and it was just a beautiful thing. So all of this still exists in Tennessee. It's a cliche to say Tennessee's the cradle of American music and all this, but all this stuff really is here. It's really here.
Well, you know, my friends that are in the natural resources side of life always talk about the Tennessee Valley being the richest ecological region in the nation, just because of the diversity of geologic features and all the water and climate, etc. But I've always thought that was true also culturally.
Yeah.
And there's a relationship between those things.
I think so.
Yeah.
People have said, you know, you need to look at the Tennessee culture areas like you do the regional areas. You know, the West Tennessee is more similar to Mississippi, perhaps, and East Tennessee is more similar to these other Appalachian states. And this is obvious, but Tennessee is just a sliver that kind of covers all those grounds.
You know, one of the things that is always of interest to me is food ways. You know, I guess it's cliche, but we've got the Nashville chicken. The Nashville hot chicken has become famous worldwide, but there's all kinds of food culture in Tennessee.
Oh yeah, and we're starting to work with that. You know, it's
tell us more.
It's how do I want to say this? If you're a folklorist and you're working in a humanities council, it's easier to frame food as a subject worthy of study and research. If you're working in an arts council, it's a somewhat harder
study. Not so much, yeah.
Well, maybe in the past, but I'll tell you, our current management and the crew together, they do see Foodways as an art form, as a folklife art form. And so, you know, Benton Bacon, Benton Ham.
Sure. I saw them on your website. Yeah.
He got our state folklife award a few years ago, which sort of opened the gates to this. We're trying to work closely with a cannery in Stanton, Tennessee. There's an African-American man who has been running a cannery there, a public cannery. You come in and get your food canned. And he knows all these incredible recipes for, chow chow and all these things.
Exactly, yeah.
And he's up in his 80s, and we really want him to train an apprentice.
You know, that was something that occurred in many, many counties in Tennessee historically. I could remember living in Sevier County, the county fair site was the site of a communal cannery.
Yeah.
Where people would bring, vegetable crops that were seasonal, and in other words, the harvest lasted 2 weeks, and that was that. The green bean crop, for example,
yeah.
And they would bring, truckloads of beans in to be canned because none of the farmers independently had the means to have all the apparatus necessary to do it.
And I think the Stanton Cannery is a descendant of that movement.
Sure.
That is still up and running.
Now, where are they located?
Stanton is in West Tennessee.
Okay.
It's now run by the city of the city of Stanton took over the cannery and have been applying for grants to refurbish the equipment and et cetera, and teach the tradition. They documented dozens of Richard Turner, his canner's name, his recipes. We've tried to work with the sorghum makers. By try, I just mean we haven't gotten them into our program quite yet. One of the reasons, there's a technical reason, our program runs from November to June, our apprenticeship program. That cuts out the summer.
I see.
We're working on fixing that time frame so we can get more of these agricultural traditions, even mountain gardening, seed saving. These kinds of things are traditional art forms, traditional knowledge, and we want to get better at working with them.
Yeah, gardening by the signs.
Right.
Right. That was something I never knew about until I lived in East Tennessee and was gardening.
I might need to try that with some of the trouble I have with my garden.
Yeah, I think that, from region to region in the state, there are people that have different viewpoints about that. But so tell us... how can the ordinary citizen of Tennessee plug into your program? I certainly they can pay attention to the various events and festivals, but how can they also be a participant?
Well, it depends on what they want to do. If they're a traditional artist or have an art form or tradition that's been passing along in their family and they want to pass it on, they might want to talk to us about doing an apprenticeship. We have had people do apprenticeships who had no clue what folklife was.
Right.
That wasn't a term they knew. We worked with a shoe cobbler last year in Memphis. He'd never heard of probably the Tennessee Arts Commission, but we read about him. So these can even be occupational traditions, as you mentioned earlier.
Sure.
If you're someone deeply interested in this, even deeply interested in documenting it in your own family traditions, we're trying to build a community scholars program for those folks, meaning we're going to take some workshops out to different regions of the state to teach people how to document this like a folklorist would and do things with it that a folklorist might do. So we're talking about good quality photography, video, audio, using the best gear you can get your hands on. Even if that's your smartphone, there are strategies to do a good job. And then maybe doing an exhibit, or doing a podcast, or doing a video online, or even doing a festival or concert. I think if you're not yourself an artist, but you're interested in this, my encouragement would be to look at your own community, look at what's there, look deeply, ask around, what are the traditions of your community? Who are the people that are doing interesting things in your community? And how can you help not just document them, but make them feel important? I think one of the most powerful tools that I have as a state folklorist is just saying to people, the state of Tennessee formally, officially values you and what you're doing. Even if the world at large has forgotten about this, or if you're a young person and the world at large isn't telling you to be an old-time fiddler, we're saying it's valued. We're here. We want to tell your story. If people want to just plug into the things we're doing, they can also look at our Facebook page, our website. Like everybody else, we're trying to put digital content up as much as we can in these times, and we're building more and more on that. But I can't stress enough that we all need, we who care about the culture of Tennessee, if we can work on our own communities to help locate, preserve, and present that stuff, it goes a long way. It has a huge snowball effect.
Well, you know, we've had since 1970, we've had an in-migration into Tennessee, and people bringing all kinds of new things in. We've talked about the Hispanic and other immigrant groups, but you know, at the same time, there's the old-time Tennessee and a lot of authenticity that's getting washed away. It's you know, people are living their life and they're dying, and the traditions die with them.
Yeah, it certainly happens that, you know, these things come and go. It's just a fact of life. If we're down to one person that knows how to do something, if you know about that, try to record them. Try to learn about what they're doing, and try to learn what they're doing. If you're new to Tennessee, I can say this: there have been plenty of organizations that have benefited from the support of retirees. Retirees have time. If they're from another state, try to get them interested in the culture of Tennessee and support it, especially the young people. An example of this is in Campbell County. So many retirees there that are living on Norris Lake or in the community have tried to do their best to support the young people of Campbell County, learn about, embrace their own traditions. That's the ideal situation.
Right.
Respect the traditions of the state you moved to. Become a student of them. Don't be a know-it-all.
Right.
I feel that way. You know, Roby Cogswell, my predecessor, was a lifelong Tennessean, and when he retired, I think he said something to the effect that he felt like he'd been paid to be a professional Tennessean. I thought that was wonderful. I'm not a native Tennessean, but Tennessee has given me so much over the past 15 years. So much. My job, met my wife here, countless of the greatest friends I've ever had. But I still feel like I'm a student of Tennessee. I'm a guest. I'm a student.
Good for you.
And I think if folks take that attitude, that can really mean a lot to people who don't always feel like their culture has been embraced, even by their neighbors or by the rest of the state or the rest of the world.
Bradley, if people want to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, they can email me at bradley.a.hanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, at tn.gov, or message me through our Facebook.
Which is how I got a hold of you.
Yep. Yeah. It's just tn/tnfolklife after facebook.com. tnfolklife.org is our website. And yeah, check us out. We need to spread the word. We look at our numbers sometimes of you know, reach and hits and all this stuff that you can obsess about. And I always think there must be more people than this interested in folk life. We just got to find them.
Right. Well, I'm sure there are. And hope we'll do our best to get the message out. Do you all have a calendar of events that you keep current of what's going on?
Kind of. It's not a calendar of events like you would think. It's a listing of events that typically happen in certain months of the year.
Okay.
The resource that we provide, because, you know, things change dates. But if you look, you can see all, and it's on our resources tab. If you go to our website,
okay,
it's events, and it shows all the contests, all hundreds of events. You can click through to them to see what the dates are. And that's the best way to see what's going on.
Super. Well, Bradley Hanson, thank you so much for your time today and for introducing us to what's going on at the Tennessee Folklore Project.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And